called us to do. If you're there in Matthew chapter 20, beginning in verse 1, I have a question for you as we begin our lesson this evening. Is it lawful for God to do what He wishes with His things? Is it lawful for God to do what He wishes with His things? I've said this several times. Can I hear your head rattle? Especially as we think about God's grace. Is it not lawful for God to do what He wishes with His grace? In Matthew chapter 20, beginning in verse 1, we find what we call the parable of the laborers in the vineyard. And this is a parable that is only found in Matthew's gospel. And maybe that makes sense because Matthew was a tax collector and he probably thought about things in terms of something that was owed, something that you have to pay, as that was his job, something that he had done through the years. It is spoken in the context of the Lord's last week on earth before His crucifixion. So He's making forgiveness available to all people. That's about to happen in Jerusalem. And it's also in the context of the disciples' attitude toward who was going to be greatest in the kingdom of God. And so they had this kind of spiritual arrogance and entitlement just after this parable is the occasion where James and John's mama comes and says, "Hey, let my son sit on your right hand and on your left hand in your kingdom." And it's a parable that, like all the parables, takes a common scene, something that everybody would have known about, everybody would have been familiar with. But unlike a lot of the other parables, this particular parable of Jesus turns that common thing that people would have known about on its head and gives us an unexpected, uncommon outcome. And this parable has applications to us and it has applications to God's grace and God's kingdom. So let's read it together, Matthew chapter 20, beginning in verse 1, with all of that context in mind. Jesus says, "For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard." Typically, during the grape harvest, you would have hired a lot of extra workers to come and work in reaping these grapes. Verse 2, "Now when he had agreed with the laborers for a denarius a day," that's a fair standard day's wage in the ancient world, "he sent them into his vineyard. And he went out again about the third hour and saw others standing idle in the marketplace." In the ancient world, it was a 12-hour workday from 6 in the morning till 6 in the evening or thereabouts as we count time. And so at 6 in the morning, he goes and hires these people, sends them into his vineyard. At 9 in the morning, he goes back to the marketplace and hires more and sends them into the vineyard. And to this point, this is a fairly standard sort of practice. That would have been something that Jesus' hearers would have been very familiar with. And even in our culture, in our time, it's not uncommon to have some sort of meeting place where you can go and you can hire day laborers. When I was living in Lindale, Texas, that was the Lindale Public Library. And if you needed help on a project, you could go up there early on a Saturday morning and there'd be some men waiting around and you say, "Hey, I need two or three workers today," and you'd talk to them and agree on how much you're going to pay them, and then you could go and work on your project. Y'all have something like that in this area? I'm sure you do. But that's a fairly common idea both then and now. But after this point, things start to get a little weird. So he says to them, "You also go into the vineyard, and whatever is right, I will give you." So they went. So who's in a better position at this point? The people that he agreed to a denarius a day, or these people who says, "Just go and work, whatever's right, I'll pay you." And if you're not sure who's in a better position, I want you to imagine that your boss comes up to you here in December and says, "You know, your wage, your salary for this next year is going to be whatever I think is right. I'm just going to pay you what I think is right." How would you feel if your employer said that to you? And so clearly these people who agreed on a wage were in a better position, but these others who were hired at 9 in the morning agree to go and work as well. And then things get stranger, verse 5. "And again he went out about the 6th hour and the 9th hour," so noon and 3 in the afternoon, "and he did likewise. And then about the 11th hour," so 5 in the afternoon, there's only 1 hour of the workday left, "he went out and found others standing idle. and said to them, why have you been standing here idle all day? And they said to him, because no one hired us. And he said to them, you also go into the vineyard, and whatever is right, you will receive. So when evening had come, the owner of the vineyard said to his steward, call the laborers and give them their wages, beginning with the last, so the last people who were hired, to the first. And when those who came, who were hired about the 11th hour, they each received a denarius. But when the first came, they supposed that they would receive more, but they likewise received each a denarius. And when they had received it, they complained against the landowner, saying, these last men have worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden and the heat of the day. Now, what was their objection? Was their objection that he was paying them a denarius? Not really. Their objection was that he was paying these other people a denarius and paying them a denarius as well. Their objection was his generosity, what we would call his grace toward other people, not the price that they agreed with at the beginning, which they were all fine with. And so we see that the landowner is going to answer them. Verse 13, he says, he answered unto them and said, friend. Now, just as an aside, whenever you hear that word friend in the Gospel of Matthew, it's always used ironically. It's like saying, friend, you're not being very friendly. I'm calling you friend, but you're not acting like a friend. He says, friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what is yours and go your way. I wish to give to this last man the same as you. Is it not lawful for me to do what I wish with my own things? Or is your eye evil because I am good? New American Standard says, is your eye envious because I am generous? So Jesus makes the application, verse 16. So the last will be first and the first last, for many are called, but few are chosen. This is a parable that has a lot of implications and applications that we could make from it. But I want us to focus specifically about how this is a parable about God's grace. And it hinges on the question that the landowner asks, that God asks there in verse 15. Is it not lawful for me to do what I wish with my own things? And the first order of business this afternoon for our lesson is to answer that question. Is it not lawful for God to do what he wishes with his own things, including his grace? And I need more than just a head rattle on this one. I need a thumbs up or a thumbs down on this one. Is it not lawful for God to do what he wishes with his things? If you answered yes to that question, then you're ready for the rest of the lesson. You're ready to appreciate God's grace as it is described in this passage. To appreciate God's grace, we must do three things that are found in this parable. And I'm just going to warn you tonight, I have one main point, one primary point, and then I have two kind of smaller subpoints that come out of that main point. Now, I tell you that just for this reason. If I'm going for a while and you start looking at your watch and you're like, he's still on his first point, don't panic, because we have one main point that we're going to spend most of our time on, and then two secondary points that kind of flow from that main point. So here is the main point that we need to get from this parable. To appreciate God's grace, we must, number one, change our viewpoint of what we think is fair, and specifically what we think we deserve. Now, I want you to be honest. I mean, you're good Christian people. Of course, you're honest. But I want you to be honest. Does this parable strike you as fair? Now, I know that this is Jesus telling this parable and all those sorts of things. But I'm just asking you, put yourself in the shoes of these people who are hired, especially those people hired at the beginning of the day. Does this strike you as fair? 12 hours of work, 1 hour of work, the same amount of pay. Is that fair? We got a thumbs down back there. That doesn't strike me as fair either. Have you ever been on a group project, whether that's at school or at work, and you've ever been in a group setting like that where everybody's doing a little bit of work, but everybody gets the same grade or whatever at the end of that? You know that in every group like that, if it's not just you getting to pick the people, but if it's assigned to you especially, in every group like that, there's always that one person who's the loafer. You know, that one person who just lets everybody else do the work, and yet they take the same amount of credit as everybody else at the end of it. That loafer in every single group. And if you're thinking to yourself, well, you know, I've been in groups, but I've never had somebody like that in my group. You are that person. My wife, Stephanie, is an assistant principal. I think I've told you all that. And when she was going through grad school, she had a cohort. So it was the same group of people who are going through taking the same classes. And there was this one guy in her cohort who was a really nice guy, you know, all those sorts of things. This is where I say bless his heart, right? But he always wanted to be in Stephanie's group. If it was ever time for a group project, he'd raise his hand and say, I'm with Stephanie. Whatever group Stephanie's in, I'm with Stephanie. And every single time it went something like this. Stephanie and whoever else was in the group would do the work. And then when it's about time to turn in the project, he would email everybody and say, do you want me to turn in our project? And yet at the end of it all, he's got the same grade, he's got the same degree, all those sorts of things. Now we see that and we say there's something fundamentally unfair about that. To get the same credit with the boss, to get the same grade on the project for far less work. There's a pretty well-known famous quote. It's possibly by Plato or Thomas Jefferson, depending on what you read. We're not entirely sure who said this. But it goes something like this. Little seems more unequal than the equal treatment of unequals. But that, beloved, is where our viewpoint is wrong in regard to God's grace. We are all equals when it comes to God's grace because we are all sinners in need of grace. Not workers getting, or in our own minds, earning what we deserve. Who do you imagine yourself to be in this parable? We know the landowner is God, right? But who do you imagine yourself to be? I don't know about you, but I'm a hard worker. I grew up working on the farm. I told the story to Steve that my dad came in when I was 14, turned on the light the third day of summer and said, get up, son, I've got you a job. And so I've been working all my life and I know how to work hard. I'm a hard worker. And so in my own mind, I imagine that I'm these people who were there in the marketplace before 6 a.m. and worked all day long. That's what I imagine in my mind. But the more we can start to identify ourselves, the closer we get to the ones called at the 11th hour, the more clearly we are seeing our predicament in sin and God's grace toward us. None of us are those first workers, but even the first workers forgot where they were before the landowner called them. Where were they? They were unemployed, waiting in the marketplace for a job. And we too sometimes forget that we were all sinners when God called us. Do you remember what it was like? Do you remember what it was like to be called out of your sin? Do you remember what it was like to be forgiven of those sins? Do you remember what it was like to be clean and holy when moments before you were condemned unclean? What would happen if you or I got what we deserved? What do I deserve? What do you deserve? Because of my sin, not because of Adam's or anybody else's, because of my sin, I deserve to go to hell. And those who seek justification on a merely legal basis will be sorely disappointed. Robert Capone said, if the world could have been saved by good bookkeeping, it would have been saved by Moses, not by Jesus. If we want justice, if we want what is fair, then we will get hell.
Philip Yancey says of this parable in his little book on grace, which I can't actually recommend the book itself. The book itself was not very good, but this particular part actually was. It's kind of this little golden nugget amidst a bunch of stuff that wasn't particularly good. But this is what he says of this parable. Will you listen carefully to these words? Jesus' story makes no economic sense, and that was his intent. He was giving us a parable about grace, which cannot be calculated like a day's wages. We like to think of ourselves as responsible workers, and the employer's strange behavior baffles us, as it no doubt did the original hearers. We risk missing the story's point, that God dispenses gifts, not wages. None of us gets paid according to merit, for none of us comes close to satisfying God's requirements for a perfect life. If paid on the basis of fairness, we would all end up in hell. And that's what the scriptures teach as well, of course. You think about the book of Romans. Turn to Romans chapter 3. We read a few verses from Romans chapter 3 this morning. Let's read a few more from the third chapter of Romans. Romans chapter 1 shows that the Gentiles are condemned under sin. They could have known God, but they chose not to. They weren't graceful. They weren't thankful for what God has done. And then in chapter 2, Paul turns to the Jews and says, you're not better off. In fact, you're worse off because you could have known God. You had the law of Moses, and yet still you're committing a lot of the same sins that the Gentiles are committing. And so he says in Romans chapter 3 and beginning there in verse 10, look there in verse 9. What then? Are we better than they? Not at all. For we have previously charged both Jews and Greeks that they are all under sin. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. Drop down to verse 12. They have all turned aside. They have together become unprofitable. There is none who does good, no, not one. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't ever do anything that is good. Raise your hand if you have ever done anything good in your entire life. Raise your hand if you've ever done anything good in your entire life. If you're not raising your hand, maybe we have bigger issues to talk about, right? We all have done good things in our life. Even perhaps the worst person you know at some point has done something good for somebody. But the point that's being made in the book of Romans is that we don't only do what is good. All of us have done things that are not good, even things that we might call evil, certainly things that we would call sinful. We don't always do good. No one has only done good except for Christ himself. And so if we drop down to verse 19, he says, now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty before God. We see our sin and know that we're guilty before God. Therefore, by the deeds of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. But now, the righteousness of God, apart from the law, God's plan to save us and make us righteous, is revealed, being witnessed by the law and the prophets. Even the righteousness of God through faith in Christ Jesus to all and on all who believe. For there is no difference, Jew or Greek or people then, people now, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, being justified freely by his grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God set forth as a propitiation by his blood through faith to demonstrate his righteousness. Because in his forbearance, God passed over the sins that were previously committed to demonstrate at the present time his righteousness, that he might be two things, just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. It is because of Christ's sacrifice that God can still be just, and you and I can be justified before him and have the opportunity to be with him eternally instead of going to hell. And there's more that we could talk about here as he uses Abraham as an example and so forth, but drop down to chapter 4 and verse 4. He kind of summarizes all of this by saying this. Now to him who works, If you're trying to work in order to receive your salvation, the wages are not counted as grace, but as debt. The English Standard Version says, as is his due. And so the overall message, I think, is really clear to us. Only if we work perfectly can God's salvation be counted as a debt, as a wage, as something that is owed to us instead of a gift. But because we have all sinned, none of us can be justified by perfect law keeping, like in the law of Moses. We all need God's grace. So this is where we have to start if we're going to understand God's grace. That I, hear me clearly, Reagan Allen, I was in the same situation as all other sinners. And I am not better, I am not more deserving, just because I might view my sins as smaller than other people. Ephesians chapter 2 that we've read several times, verses 1 through 5, speaks to that very idea. That all of us, Jews and Gentiles, all of us were dead in our trespasses and sins, in which we all once walked, according to the course of this world, according to the devil, the prince of the power of the air. And we all conducted ourselves in the lust of the flesh, in the lust of our mind. And our habitual practice, the way we lived, was such that we were separated from God because of the things that we did. And just because I came to my senses faster than others, or even if they haven't come to their senses yet to come to God, that doesn't mean that I didn't need the same mercy and grace as them. And so we need to know clearly that we have no reason to boast because we have come to Jesus Christ, even in comparison to those who have not. We are saved on the basis of God's grace through our faith, not on the basis of perfect obedience. If you're still there in Matthew chapter 20, if you've marked that, go back there. And I think we see that in this parable as well. We have to see God's grace. And it is God who says there in the second part of verse 14, I wish to give to this last man the same as you. When all was said and done, every worker got what they needed. Every worker got what God wished to give. And we might be jealous of someone if they are paid the same as us for doing much, much less. If we view it as, well, I'm getting what I deserve and they're not getting what they deserve. But I want you to change just one thing about this parable. Okay? I want you to imagine for a moment that in modern days, you're in this exact scenario. You're hired at 6 a.m. and you're hired to work all day long, and there's an agreed upon amount that you're going to be paid. And then there's some other people that trickle in through the end of the day. In fact, some people are hired with just 1 hour left in the day, and now you're standing in line to receive wages from the person who hired you. And so the person in front of you who has only worked 1 hour comes to the person who hired you both. And that person says, the person who hired says, here's your check for $250 million for 1 hour of work. And then they take out another check and hand it to you and say, here's your check for $250 million for 12 hours of work. How would you respond if that was real? How would you respond to that? That is not fair. You paid that guy the same amount as me. I worked 12 hours for my $250 million. He only worked 1 hour for his. Of course not. We'd be high-fiving that guy. I mean, can you believe that we both have been paid so much more than what we deserve? Can you believe the generosity of the man who hired us in giving us far beyond what we have earned? Loved ones, that's salvation in Jesus Christ, if we can see it. That all of us are receiving so far above and beyond what it is we deserve. All of us are saved by God's grace. far more than a fair wage. It is a gift that has to be free because it can't be bought. Such is its incalculable value. And we need to be able to see, to change our viewpoint on what we think is fair. None of us deserve salvation in Jesus Christ. And all of us are saved by God's grace. But I think there is maybe another hidden side of this idea of what is fair, of what we think we deserve. You know, some people think that they deserve it. They wouldn't express it that way. But some people say, well, I've been super faithful. I've lived this faithful life. I kind of deserve to go to heaven. But I think there are other people who are faithful Christians who know they don't deserve it. But they are still working, thinking somehow that they have to earn it back, that they have to earn heaven. And in some places, somewhere along the way, and I'm not passing judgment on preachers or hearers, I'm just acknowledging the reality that some Christians got the wrong impression. And how discouraging would this understanding be, that I'm going to have to be perfect, or maybe not actually perfect, but just like almost perfect, if I have any hope whatsoever of going to heaven. That it's all about me and my works and my obedience. And for a long time I didn't see this because it wasn't my understanding and it wasn't my experience. But here it's been a couple of years ago. There's a very faithful member in the church back at Timberland. This man has devoted his life to Jesus. Through the years, he has done so many good and generous things for so many people, both Christians and non-Christians. He's been active in the church. He's been a leader in the church. He raised faithful children. And we were standing in the foyer one time, and I was just dumbfounded by what he said to me. He said, "Reagan, I just don't know if I've done enough. I just don't know if I'm good enough to go to heaven." And that smacked me upside the head. That this man, with all that he's done, had all of this doubt about whether he was going to go and be with God eternally or not. Now, this is bold and personal. We've gotten to know each other really well over the course of only 3 days, but just bear with me for a second, if you are willing. I'm curious, who worries about that? Are you willing to raise your hand and say, "Sometimes I worry that I'm not good enough to go to heaven"? Are you willing to raise your hand? I am so sorry that I didn't realize there were so many struggling with that. So let me say this. If you're worried about not being good enough, I have news for you. You're not good enough. So you're never going to feel good enough based on your own works and your own merit. Let me state this clearly. Short of perfection, you can't earn your way to heaven. And God doesn't expect you to. The good news of the gospel is that he sent his son Jesus so that you wouldn't have to earn your own way. God is a God who loves to give good gifts. And occasionally his gifts are without requirements. We've talked about how God's grace requires something of us. Occasionally he gives gifts that don't require anything from us. You know, it's rained here today. What does Jesus say? God sends his rain on the just and on the unjust. But the reality is, when it comes to God's saving grace and the gifts that he gives by that grace, there are requirements. Almost always there are requirements to receive his gifts. March around the city 7 days and 7 times on the 7th day and scream with a great shout. Go and wash in the pool of Siloam. Build an ark. Dip 7 times in the Jordan River. Pick up the axe head that is now floating. And many, many more. But even with those requirements, they are still gifts. And none of us deserve it. And so we can be so grateful that God has saved us even when we don't. And we need to focus on the grace that he has given us that we don't deserve much more. and maybe far less on what others might get that we don't think they deserve. This is the main thing we must see to appreciate God's grace from this passage.
We have to change our viewpoint of what we think is fair, of what we think we deserve. But let me make two kind of secondary points that go with that. Number two, we have to change our viewpoint of who has the right to determine the conditions of the gift.
You know, people talk a lot about the sovereignty of God when it comes to grace and salvation. And it seems to me, many then immediately violate that sovereignty. People say, God is absolutely sovereign. So, they say, that means that God can't require anything of you. And my question is, well, who says? You? You say that God, a sovereign God who is above all and sees all and knows all, that God, now you're telling that God what he can and can't do? Are you telling the sovereign God that he can't require anything? Doesn't God's sovereignty mean that he is the one who gets to decide what is required and what isn't? It is God's decision, not ours. And yet what we do sometimes is we often make the same mistake as those first workers. There in verse 10, did you catch that? It says, they supposed. They saw what was happening and they said to themselves, I've got this thing figured out. I know what's fair. I know what they deserve and I know what I deserve. And they put themselves in the place of the landowner, in the place of God, and said, this is what he should or shouldn't do. Maybe even this is what he can and can't do. And before we talk about what is required, can we agree on this point, that God has the right to set the conditions of the gifts that he gives? Can we agree that God has that right? For the third time, let us agree on that. And it is always dangerous to start supposing with God. When we start forcing our standards on him, we will rarely come out in the right place. And that's what too many do today. God makes the choice of what he will or won't do and what we can or can't do. Did you see that in the text? Notice verses 4 and 7 and 14 and 15. Notice there in verse 4, God says, you also go into the vineyard and whatever is right, I will give you. At the end of verse 7, he says, you also go into the vineyard and whatever is right, you will receive. Drop down to verse 14. Take what is yours and go your way. I wish to give to this last man the same as you. Is it not lawful for me to do what I wish with my own things? God has the right to set the conditions on the grace that he gives. And maybe you say, okay, but God doesn't require anything of us. Is that what we see in this parable? Is that what we see in the rest of our Bible? Even those who were called at the 11th hour that nobody else liked because they only worked 1 hour, even those people still had to do what? They still had to come when they were called by God, even at the very end. And we have no right to point to God and say, well, you can't require anything. No, God can require whatever he wills. And aren't we glad that he's the one who sets those requirements? The one who created us, the one who knows us better than we know ourselves, the one who loves us so much that he gave his son for us. That's the being who says, this is what you must do. Surely the things that he requires are both, number one, things that we can do, but number two, the things that are best for us anyway. And so God is the one who has the right to determine the conditions of the gifts that he gives, including his salvation. And so we should not complain about the way things are done or the way things are judged or the way things are given. That's whittling on God's end of the stick. All we must do is trust and obey. And if he requires faith or confession or repentance or baptism, it's his right to require what he wills to receive his salvation. Won't you just do it? Won't you just obey this God who loves you so much and desires to save you? And then finally, number three, to appreciate God's grace, we must change our viewpoint of what we want for others to make it more like God. God was wanting to give good gifts to all of these people here. And then the issue comes down to those who were hired at the beginning didn't want him to give good gifts to other people. We have to change our viewpoint of what we want for others to make it more like God. And here is the sad reality. There will be some who will come close to forfeiting eternal life because of their own spiritual pride. Did you notice what he said to them there in verse 14? He has to say to these people who came at the beginning, take what is yours and go your way. He had to tell them to take what was theirs. And we say, that can't be, really? They're going to work all day, and because they don't like God giving good gifts to other people, they're going to walk away from the gift that they've been given? And yet it is pride to believe that we can be forgiven because we aren't that bad. But they, whoever they are, they can't be forgiven because they are too bad. And we may be surprised in the judgment day to find them saved and us not. Especially, I think this applies when it comes to those who have sinned against us. Especially when it is someone that we view as a vile sinner. You know, those revolting sins, those inexplicable sins, those sins that have huge physical consequences. You know, instead of just the regular old sins like what I commit. I want everyone to be saved. Try that statement on for size. Let it roll around on your mouth and tongue. I want everyone to be saved. Say it with me, if you're willing. Are you willing to do that? Let's say it together. I want everyone to be saved. Like Everyone. Because that's what God wants. God desires all men, anthropos, all people, to be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth. Now let's be careful. This is not something where God is going to wink at sin or overlook unrepentant sin or that there are no consequences when we do sin. But God's desire and ours should be such that we want all to come to repentance, to know the grace of God, and be saved from their sins. And yes, God is just. And God's justice means that those who are unrepentant, unpenitent, will be judged. But our desire should be like God's, that I want everyone to be saved. But if we question the long-suffering of God toward those who have sinned more than us or those who have worked less than us, we might be tempted to give up our own salvation rather than accept that these other people can be saved too. Remember, it is really God who people have sinned against the most. And maybe they've sinned against us too, but however they've sinned against us, they have sinned against God far more. But we tend to take those things really personally. And it's tough not to. But maybe that's where this change in perspective is especially helpful to us. So I just had the first practice with my younger daughter, Brooklyn. Her first basketball practice was this past Tuesday. I have coached her every year except for one. And there was one year when she came to me and said, Daddy, I want somebody else to coach me, be on another team. And of course, I felt horrible about that and didn't want that to happen. But I said, sure, baby, if that's what you want, that sounds great. And she was on another team. And after one practice, she said, Daddy, I wish you would coach me. Well, I had a new experience. I'd coached Madison, my older daughter, all through her basketball years. And then I was coaching Brooklyn all through those little dribbler years before they get to school ball. And so for the first time in my life, I'm just a parent in the stands instead of a coach on the sideline when it comes to my girls. And I'd always behaved myself pretty much as a coach. But now I'm in the stands. And let me tell you, that's different, right? That's pretty tough when, you know, your kid's out there and you don't have any control whatsoever of the game and what's going on. And there was this one occasion where we're playing this other team and we weren't very good, but we were hanging with them. We had a chance to win this game.
And one of our players was throwing the ball in from the sideline. And across the way was a girl on the other team that I had coached the year before. And she was really aggressive. You know, she was one who got in there and wanted to steal the ball. And so she's jumping up and down and she's waving her hands. And finally, she's just had enough. And this girl on the other team steps across the line out of bounds, takes the ball away from the girl who's throwing it in, dribbles down to the other end, shoots and makes a basket, and the refs call nothing. And I'm up out of my seat and I'm yelling at these, you know, high school refs, and I'm saying, they can't do that. You got to take the points off the board. They stepped out of bounds. That's illegal. We can't do that. And Stephanie's over there patting me on the leg, you know, pat. And I turn and I look down the court and I see the girl who had the ball taken away from her. And she's coming back up the court and this is the way she's doing it. And I see that and I slowly sit back down. Because if the one who was really sinned against is over it, how can I still be so mad about it? Loved ones, if God has forgiven someone, if they have truly repented of the sin that they have committed, how can we harbor hatred and resentment in our heart? How can we refuse to forgive? And yes, as we've said over and over, there still may be physical consequences to that sin, but we must let it go and forgive. God was sinned against more than any of us, so we must leave it in His hands. Let God decide what is required for forgiveness. And I can accept, I can even rejoice in His perfect judgment on the matter. Why? Because God's grace is motivated by His love and anxiety for and long-suffering toward all people. 5 times God goes back into the marketplace. 5 times He goes and calls these people to come and work in His vineyard, and He will give them what is right. And that includes me and that includes you. He desperately wants you to come. He has made the way. He has prepared the place. And He is asking you in loving, long-suffering concern, why are you still idle? What are you waiting for? Won't you come? Whatever is right in God's sight, you will receive. This past year, there was a young man, he's now a senior in high school, and he's someone that I've known. Stephanie and I are counselors at a camp in Tennessee every year, and I've known this young man since he was in the 4th grade, and he came to me this past year at camp, and he said he wanted to be baptized, and we sat down and studied, and he knew everything that he needed to know. There was no doubt about that, and so I asked him, I said, you know, why have you been waiting? And he said, you know, I've been waiting and I don't know why. I have thought about it every day for the last year. And I think sometimes we find ourselves in that kind of loop. We're standing idle in the marketplace and we hear the call of God, but we don't respond and we don't respond. And yet it is God's long-suffering and grace that has waited to this point. And what He desires so desperately is for you to hear His voice and to respond. You've been called by the God of the universe to come and work in His vineyard and to receive the inheritance of His saints. Won't you come and become one of the chosen? By putting Christ on in baptism and rising to walk in newness of life. And if you're willing, won't you come now while together we stand and while we sing?